myself. My name is Glenn Mogelson. I'm from Los Alamos, New Mexico. I work at Los Alamos National Laboratory. That is one of the national laboratories in the United States, one of the main national laboratories. Los Alamos has been involved in nuclear weapons research since 1941, I believe. So that's part of what the laboratory does. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory is another laboratory that is involved in nuclear weapons research. Los Alamos, though, is also involved in energy research of all different types, in medical research, and I'll mention some of these things. I'll show you some pictures of what Los Alamos looks like. It's a very diverse place in science. We have biologists, environmentalists, chemists, physicists. You name a professional field in science, and it's represented in Los Alamos. It's a tremendous resource of scientists, 5,000 scientists. I've been doing research. I haven't been involved in teaching. I've been doing research since 1976 in fusion energy. So the areas that I'm talking about, the area today I'm talking about, is an area of expertise of mine. Tomorrow night at 9 o'clock, I'll be talking about energy resources. Now that's an area that I've had to study outside of my work. I'm not an expert in that area, but I felt there was a need for people to know what our energy resources are. So I'll be talking about that. And next week, I'll be talking about our energy resources. Like, for example, you know, think of an energy resource. Give me an example.
Coal.
Coal, right. What's another example?
Wind.
What?
Wind.
Wind, another example?
Water.
Water. The sun.
Okay, the sun is an energy resource.
Wood.
Wood is?
Natural gas.
Natural gas.
Oil.
Oil and gasoline, right. Nuclear energy. All of those are sources of energy, and they're used in a variety of different ways. The talk tomorrow night will be to look at those energy resources and look at how we use them. How are they a part of our life in the many different ways in which they're used? Next week, I'll be talking about what are the risks associated with each of those. That is, if you're going to use coal in the future, what is the implication of doing that? That is, what are the environmental problems with using coal that we know about? If we're going to use oil, what does that mean? What are the problems of using oil? If we're going to use nuclear energy, what are the problems with that? I'm not going to try to tell you which direction to go. I'm going to try to give you as much information as I can about each of those areas so that you have some understanding of what the problems are for us in the future. Then the last talk next week will be more theologically oriented. That is, I call it energy ethics. How do the different energy sources affect our lifestyle? What does it mean, for example, to recycle, to conserve energy? I'll try to illustrate, for example, that in the future, it could mean that our family management, the number of children that you have, is going to be related to energy. And so that's kind of an overview of what I want to do over the next couple weeks. The final thing, which I think you'd find fascinating if you have a chance to attend a little bit of it, I'm on the Science and Technology Committee for Holden. At the end of next week, on Friday and Saturday, we have a meeting here. And so there will be scientists that will come in from all parts of the country and will look at some of the problems that Holden has You know, Holden is a nurturing place, but it's a city. It's a city in the wilderness. And it has all the problems that a city has. We have a hydroelectric power plant out there to give us light. We have garbology. We have tanks of diesel fuel. We have wood that's used during the winter. All these things cause problems and trade-offs for the village. And we'll be talking about those things. One of the most recent things that I'm sure probably almost nobody knows of here, unless you've gone to those meetings, is that the water tank that we use is going to have to be replaced. It's about 70,000 gallons capacity, and that is not enough, according to the state of Washington, for fire protection here. And so it's going to have to be increased to 120,000 gallons. And so we talked about that in March, for example. So you have all of those issues associated with the city, which are similar to all the issues of any city. And they give you a feeling for what's involved. So that's a long introduction. But I thought that I would like to do one other thing. As I mentioned, I'm a scientist, I'm a physicist. That's my profession. I am a human being with a lot of other interests and situations that might be of benefit to you. So I thought I'd tell you a little bit about that, so that if you wanted to share things with me later or want to talk about something different, you would have that information for you. I have two children. I have an 18-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old son. I'm a single parent. My wife died about a year ago, a little over a year and a half ago. I enjoy I enjoy coaching, for example. I was a soccer coach for about 6 years. If you're interested in soccer, you know, that's an area that I've been involved in for a while. I've taught catechism. Now, I'm not a teacher, but I've taught catechism for about 20 years. So that's another area that I found interesting in my life. Another area is that I'm a collector. And so I have been interested in wine. And I have a wine collection and studied wine for 20 years or so. So those are kind of a diverse bunch of different things that I wanted to share with you about me as a person. And I'm also studied astrophysics. In fact, that was my main area of physics before I went into energy research. So with that being a long introduction, let me start off by telling you three things that I want you to remember. More than anything else. The first thing is that my area is fusion. Okay. We have a lot of nuclear power plants. Those nuclear power plants generate energy through the fission process. And so there's two different sources of nuclear energy, possibly. The fusion source hasn't been proven yet. It's a research area. Fission is available, but it's a different process. And what's the difference? Okay, fission, you take uranium or something like that, plutonium could be used, means that you're splitting. You split the atom, you split uranium. And in that splitting process, you create energy. And that's what fission is about. So you have a heavy element, you fissure it, and you get energy from that process. That energy is captured, and through some process, you, for example, you convert it from heating a material into a steam, and then use the steam to generate energy, as you do in almost any other kind of facility. That is fission. Okay? Fusion means that you're combining And as you fuse atoms together. So in this case, in the things I'll be talking about, what you're doing is you're taking heavy water, deuterium, and tritium, which is a heavier form of water, and you fuse them together, and in the fusing process, you release energy. So those are the two differences, fusion and fission. That's the first thing that I would like you to remember, because that's confusing to people. When we talk about nuclear energy, there's really two different sources of nuclear energy, fission and fusion. The second thing is that the reason that I'm spending my life involved in fusion research is that it has a source of energy, deuterium. It's a source of energy that could be available to almost every country on Earth. And it could last much longer than any other source except the sun. And so I've spent 15 years of my life pursuing it because I feel that it's a source of energy for the future, not only my children's generation, but for generations to come for thousands of years. And that it's not just a source of energy for the United States, it's a source of energy for everyone on Earth. With that, I would say that the other thing that I keep in the back of my mind is that the fossil energy sources are going to disappear. And certainly coal is going to last way beyond our lifetime, but it's going to disappear. Oil will disappear maybe in our lifetime, and I'll show a view graph of that. And so that's the other thing that I'm thinking about when I'm thinking about fusion. The third thing is that, I guess, and one of the reasons why I decided to do this is that I'm concerned that people learn more about science, that people spend a little bit of their time, you know, a little bit, reading about science, trying to understand the different scientific issues so that they can participate in the evaluation process of what's going on. And what I do here is, I hope, just to give you a flavor of my environment, make you, maybe hopefully stimulate you, to look beyond what you see here. If you see a Time magazine or some article, that maybe you'll pick it up and read it for yourself and learn a little bit more. So those are three things. I've already talked about the first. I don't know, can everyone see this? Why are we interested in inertial confinement fusion? I'll talk about inertial confinement fusion. There's two kinds of fusion, magnetic confinement and inertial confinement. I'm going to talk about inertial confinement. Two different ways of getting fusion right now. All of you have heard of cold fusion, I'm sure. Is that right? This is not cold fusion. This is hot fusion, very high temperatures. Who's participating in this particular way of approaching fusion? What are the basic physics concepts? And where are we? And what do we hope, what do we find for the future? So this is my most technical talk. Now I hope I don't scare you away. If you have a question, please interrupt. It doesn't bother me one bit. And so, again, why are we interested? One of the reasons that we're interested is because it's the study of science of very high density. and high temperature. How high density, how high temperature? Unbelievable. Okay. 10 million degrees. Okay, this is really hot. In fact, I think it's beyond our imagination. How many of you saw a picture of the sun with the prominences? Okay, yeah, wasn't that neat? I mean, you had the black and you could see this object shooting out. You know, if you took a pin and dotted one of those prominences, that would be the size of the Earth. Okay, that small. Huge explosion in some cases, or a huge structure. But the temperature there is less than some of the temperatures that we're talking about here. Okay. So we're talking about really high temperature. And the other thing is, of course, the potential for energy. So why are the countries, which I'll mention in the near term, why are they interested in fusion? This is a guess, by the way. This is a guess at what's going to happen to our oil reserves. They're going to go up, and then we're going to get to a point where it gets more and more difficult to extract the oil, and more much less of it is available, and it's going to begin to go down. Probably most of you have seen a Gaussian kind of curve. This is what we expect. Okay, but it's a guess. So you can see that most people in science don't believe that we're going to be able to use much oil beyond about 2050. Okay. How about coal? Coal is much better. You can see that even, and I'll show you a picture in my next talk that gives you some feeling for the reserves of coal in our country. We have fantastic reserves of coal. The coal has all kinds of problems associated with it. And so we've got to do a lot of manipulation with coal, as we do with the other energy sources, but particularly coal. And you'll better understand that if you go to a lecture that I'm going to give next week. Or if you're interested, talk to me after the class, and I can tell you what some of the reasons are for my concern. But we have a lot of it. Now, on the other hand, by the year 2500, again, you're going to run out of it if it's used.
Question about two different bell-shaped curves there. The recoverable, does that mean the only coal that we can conceivably tap? Is that what recoverable means?
No, I don't believe so. These view graphs weren't made by me, but I think what that means is that this is the ultimate limit in the amount of coal available. That's why there's an infinity associated with it. And it could be that there's two different estimates. Again, there's disagreement, always disagreement on how much is available, and I guess they're both infinity, so I would say that they're probably disagreements. This is a different estimate. One estimate suggests that it's probably 2300, and the other one estimates is it's about 2500. But see, at this point, I would also like to say that my language is going to be different, possibly, than what you're normally listen to. I'm not going to say that this is a fact. Okay, there are very few scientific facts like this. These are estimates, and it's very hard to make an estimate like this because you have to know how we're going to use it. And so you have all kinds of things that you have to assume in order to get an estimate. And if we decided not to use coal, but to use nuclear energy, for example, or something else, then this wouldn't be correct in terms of its usage. This might surprise you. I'll throw this up just to give you a feeling for what some people are thinking. Now what's happening here is that the primary concern is the greenhouse effect. That is, you want to reduce, and the greenhouse effect is the global warming. How many of you have heard global warming? What that means, okay. You get a CO2 buildup as a result of burning coal, oil, and gas. So if you stop that, you're worried about how that's going to affect the atmosphere, and you go to solar and nuclear energy. You can see that they dominate your energy use by the year 2100. But of course, there's issues associated with that, and you have the nuclear waste, and solar energy has all these problems associated with actually getting the energy. That is, it's such a weak source of energy. You need a lot of surface area to collect it. But that's a different lecture. So why are we concerned? We're concerned because, given those estimates, you don't have enough energy after a certain period of time. There's just not enough energy to sustain the population of the Earth. This is an estimate based on 10 billion people. This is an estimate based on 15 billion people. Now, one of the things that you can ask is that, well, is it possible, and I've heard this, is it possible to change your lifestyle? Can we go back to the old way and really reduce our energy consumption? How many of you talked to a grandfather or a father about their living environment at the turn of... My father was born in 1911, and he lived on Kamado Island. You wouldn't want to go back to that situation. He was burning wood. It was not a dense population at all. Everything was covered with soot. Everything was black. It was a terrible environment. So if you're thinking about, oh gee, the good old days, there weren't good old days. Talk to people who really knew what it was like to live during that time. And so there's an energy shortfall. What do we do? How do we fill in this gap? Well, certainly one of the things that occurs to you right away, and I mentioned at the beginning, is there's a family situation here. This could be huge if everybody had six children, right? And so there's a problem there. Well, I digress for a few minutes. This is the area around Los Alamos National Laboratory. You can't see it very well. So I think the main thing that you can see is that it's a mountainous area. Okay, it's not desert. It's an area similar to this, but higher. This is another view of it, only it's upside down. This is where Los Alamos is. There was a huge explosion here that created this area, and where Los Alamos is located on a bunch of mesas. So that's the physical environment. For those of you who are familiar with the area, this is Albuquerque and this is Santa Fe. This is about 100 miles from those two points.
What created the explosion?
That's a good question. I don't know. It happened about 4 million years ago. And it was a volcanic explosion, about 10 times the power released, 10 times the power released from Mount St. Helens. So this was a really huge explosion. And you can see that it created a whole environment of its own. And the Valle Grande is a beautiful place. You go up there and you look out in this meadow. And the first, it looks like it's small. I mean, the first time I was there, it was incredible. I saw this dot, and it looked like it was close, and I thought it was some kind of animal because it looked like it was moving. And my father handed me the binoculars, and I looked at the binoculars, it was a cow. And it looked like, it was so strange to have that happen. It looked like it wasn't that far away, but it was a dot. That's the Via Grande. I think it's about 25 miles across, and that was the area left over from the explosion. This is a picture of one of the main goals of the laboratory, that is, it's an area for nuclear defense, but it's also an area of study for non-nuclear defense. We're involved in energy and technology and basic research. For example, we're involved in the program on superconductivity in the United States. We're involved in the genome. How many of you know what the Genome Project is? Okay, what you're trying to do there is you're trying to understand the structure of DNA. Okay, so you're basically plotting out all of the structure of DNA. I thought this would be good to show you because you have a feeling, probably most of you don't have a feeling for the national laboratories. But these are the national laboratories, multi-program national laboratories. Brookhaven, Oak Ridge in Tennessee, Los Alamos in Sandia, which is located in Albuquerque, Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, Berkeley, and Idaho. I don't know what the Pacific Northwest is, actually. Does anybody know?
Probably Richland, isn't it?
Is that Richland?
Okay. Well, that's where the nuclear...
That's right. I know that, but I didn't know... I haven't heard that term.
Is the Idaho Laboratory located in Boise?
No, it's not in Boise.
Well, it looks like it's near Spokane on a map, but I don't know.
Yeah, I know. It looks in a funny... Is that where Richland is?
Yeah, that's about where Richland is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was trying to remember where this is located. It's not Boise.
Well, that's near the Craters of the Moon area.
Yeah.
Pocatello?
Yeah, I think that's where it is. All right, I've gone by there a couple times. So those are your national laboratories. They're resources of scientific knowledge, and they need to be used more by our country. Los Alamos probably has, well, yeah, I think this is true. It has 4% of all the physicists in the American Physical Society. It's a huge number of scientific knowledge there.
Are these also the places then that are noteworthy because they are storage areas for nuclear or spent nuclear fuels?
No.
That has nothing to do with that, or in some cases it does? Or?
Some cases it does, and some cases it doesn't. You know, certainly Los Alamos isn't a place like that. We have a nuclear reactor, however, one of the first nuclear reactors that were built. Now this gives you an idea of, hopefully, to give you a feeling that I'm not the only one who thinks that we should be involved in fusion. The United States is not the only one who thinks we should be involved in fusion. These are the countries: Soviet Union, Japan, Britain, France, China, Italy, Poland, West Germany, Australia. All of these countries consider fusion as an area that needs to be explored, needs to be studied. These words, I don't expect you to understand. These represent different kinds of lasers. How many of you know what a laser is? How many have heard the word laser? Okay. These are just different kinds of lasers, and it tells you what country is involved. How many of you know what I mean by particle beam? Okay, yeah, that's a term that isn't as known. Have you heard of a linear accelerator? Okay. Let's see. If you take something like mercury, most of you are aware of the element mercury. I think there were some dimes that had some mercury on them. If you get it hot, that is, if I take one atom of mercury and get it hot enough, I can ionize it. By ionize it, I mean that mercury has a bunch of electrons. And if I ionize it, I can kick out one of those electrons. And so now it has a charge associated with it, which means that I can accelerate it with an electric field.
What do you mean by accelerate?
Accelerate it, I mean that if I have a force, an electric field force, that force will cause the particle to move, just as if I were to just push it with my hand. Okay?
It literally means what you're saying, in other words, I'm wondering.
Yeah.
To move it.
So you take these ions, either an ion like lithium. Now lithium may not be something familiar with you either. Lithium is a light ion. Or you take something like gold and you accelerate it to very high energies. Very high energies. Almost the speed of light. Okay, really high energy. And you use that to initiate the process that I'm going to talk about in a minute.
So you need a tunnel.
You need a driver. You need a driver.
And you need a tunnel for it to keep it enclosed, right?
What you need is in the ion concept, you need a bunch of magnets. Because the ion is being accelerated, so it's moving this way, but it wants to move this way too. So you have magnets which force it to go back to its position. So you have this whole big series of magnets. So the particle beam is going along there, and it's trying to move out, magnets push it in, tries to move out, magnets push it in. It's going along like that. Well, what happens? What is the inertial confinement? Okay, now hopefully we can get into something more. I got to ask you a question. When you think of time, what's your name?
Stuart.
When you think of time in your everyday routine, what kind of time, what's the time that you think about? An hour? 10 minutes? What's a typical time?
Okay, 15 minutes.
How about somebody else? What's a time that's a common time that
an
you
hour.
Think of? An hour? Somebody else?
Day.
Lifetime.
Lifetime? Okay. Okay, I think that's pretty normal for our ordinary time. Now, let me ask somebody a different question. Try to think about the fastest thing that you've ever seen. Okay? Have you thought about that for a minute? Fastest thing that you can ever remember seeing. What was it?
I remember seeing a picture of a bullet hitting an egg or something like that, but it was a slow-mo.
Okay, right. And did you see it just as it was penetrating the egg?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. How about something else?
Shooting star.
Okay, a shooting star.
Light.
How did you see it?
Well, you can just...
You mean turning it on?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, now, how about size? What's the smallest thing you've ever tried to pick up? What's the smallest thing you've tried to pick up? A needle?
Yeah, or a needle. Or a bead.
A bead? A little, bead like this. How many of you have seen a BB?
A BB? Screw in my watch.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
That's right. Right. Some newsprint. It's really hard to read. Yeah.
Paramecium.
A what?
Paramecium.
Okay, that's a, what is that, a bacteria or?
It's a one cell organism.
Okay, and you trying to pick it up how?
Well, or
you were looking at it?
Singly?
Mm-hmm. No, that's all right. That's all right.
And that microscope to see it, right?
Okay. The reason I'm asking this is that my time scale and my workplace is a billionth of a second. Okay. Now, I wanted you to think about that because, I mean, how do you think about a billionth of a second? I mean, when I'm talking, I say one word and it's been, what, more than a second. A billionth of a second. Okay. Not only that, I'm going to enlarge what happens now, but I have, let's say, a cylinder. So you can imagine a cylinder. I'm going to do it this way. The cylinder is like this, so it's long. And, of course, it is a cylinder. And I'm watching it close. Okay? So one end is closing like this. And then you ask yourself, you're watching it close? How can you do that? I mean, you just told me that your time scale was a billionth of a second, right? Well, I actually am. I am watching it close. My picture taking is faster than a billionth of a second. Okay, so I may take 5 pictures in a billionth of a second. And that thing will be closing in a billionth of a second. So that's my environment. It's a crazy environment. I went from astrophysics, solar physics, which was astronomical units, to billionths of a second. The size, you have a picture here of a pellet knot, of the kind of thing that we're working with, is also quite small, smaller than a BB. How many of you know what a micron is? You know what a micron is? Yeah, it's about that small, right? It's 10 to the minus 4 centimeters. And a centimeter is not even an inch. 10 to the minus 4, that means it's 1/10,000th of an inch in size. Our little spheres that we implode are maybe 200 to 300 microns in radius. So they're tiny little things. This little thing like that, you can barely see. So that's the kind of time scale. Now what do we do? What we do is we get the surface of this sphere very hot, 1,000,000 degrees. Okay, it's very hot, and all of you have, I bet all of you have experienced this. How many of you have been on a plane? Okay, now, will somebody tell me how the plane is able to fly through the air? Yeah, energy is gasoline, right? But how does that help? What does it do?
Air flow.
Yeah, right. What happens is that you're burning the energy and you're blowing out. If you can hear it, you're in an airplane, you can hear this noise. Well, that's material being thrust this way, and the airplane's going this way. Okay? So that's the reason that the airplane goes this way is because you're pushing material that way. It's the same idea. You get this very hot on the surface, it blows out, and it pushes this part inward. Okay? So that's what this picture is about. You get it hot on the surface, it blows it out, but not all of it, and you're pushing in another part until you get this compressed region in here. And this is really compressed. This is unlike anything that you see or work with. This can be 100 times solid density. Okay? It's really heavy stuff. Okay? I mean, you can imagine if it was lead, for example, it was 100 times solid density. You know, a lead block about this size weighs how much? Anybody give me an idea? About this size. A shot put? How have you done a shot put?
16 pounds?
Yeah, about 16 pounds. Now, can you imagine that 100 times that density? That means that it weighs 100 times 16 pounds. It's still the same size. Okay.
How about the material which was ablated?
That gets very, very gaseous, very low density.
But doesn't it lose, isn't that lost weight then?
Yes, it's lost. That's right. And that's an inefficiency associated with the process.
But the majority of the inertial mass remains in this.
That's right. Anyway, so that's what you're doing.
Is that radioactive?
No. This material isn't radioactive, but radioactivity is a problem for fusion energy too. And I'll talk about that later in one of the other talks. It's radioactive because initially when you're using fusion, one of the products is a neutron, and the neutron creates radioactivity. It's not the same type of radioactivity that you have in a fission plant. Okay, it's not as long life, not as long lived as the fission reactor, but you still have to worry about radioactivity in fusion, at least in the near term. Now, there are ways of developing a non-neutron fusion energy source, but those are a long time in the future. Okay, that won't be for another probably 500 years, I would guess, because it's very hard to do, unless we make some incredible advances over a much nearer term than I can envision.
Is there research, I know there's research going on to try to figure out how to clean the nuclear waste from fission plants.
Right.
But they've not been successful.
One of the things that, and I'll digress for a minute, this is about fission now. One of the things that's being explored in some areas now is a way of actually taking the nuclear waste from a fission plant and burning it. That appears to be possible. That is but there's still a lot of research that needs to be done. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you take, instead of having it waste, now you take the products from a fission power plant and you actually burn those. So you reduce the waste. You can't reduce it entirely, but you reduce the waste to a much smaller level than you would have. Now there's research that's beginning in that area, but that's a brand new area of research. Okay, that may be a feasible thing to do.
So then all of the spent nuclear fuel that they're trying to store someplace, then it's possible they can use that.
That's right. In fact, now that, again, that's a digression, but that would be a good reason for storing it, not putting it away in a place where you can't get to it. Because in fact, you may be able to use that in a beneficial way in the future.
Might it have a byproduct though that's just as dangerous, burning it?
That's something that you, that's one of the reasons why you do the research, is to find out what the byproducts are and whether or not you're in a better situation or a worse situation. That's right. Yeah.
Now you were saying you don't think these laboratories are being used enough. Is it in these areas that it's not being used enough to do all this developing and all this research?
Is that what
you meant? Or?
That's partly what I meant. The other way that they're not being used is in the sense that the process of doing research is so cumbersome in our country, in the sense that, for example, Los Alamos didn't have a budget until after January. Okay, it didn't have a budget. A fiscal year starts October 1st. We did not have a budget until the beginning of January this year. What does that mean? It means that you don't know how to employ your people because you don't know what areas are going to be funded, what areas aren't. You don't know that because everything's funded on a one-year level. And so that's a whole different area. You know, a lot of problems with our country in that sense. In addition to that, we need to communicate the ideas and the prototypes that come from the scientists to industry much faster than we're doing. Okay, and there's a lot of ideas, a lot of possibilities that come from a laboratory like Los Alamos that aren't being used in our country. What happens is that they're used in Japan and Europe, okay? Because there isn't that connection. A lot of the ideas come from us.
So it's like transistors.
Yeah. And so it's frustrating.
What is ablation?
I'll show that. Ablation is what I was talking about before. It's this kind of process where I'm heating this side. In this case, it's laser or ion beam. This side blows off, and in the blowing off process, it pushes this side, just like a plane. Okay, you're throwing out material that way, pushes the plane this way. Okay, and so that's the kind of thing that is happening there. Actually, a car engine works like that to a certain extent, but a little container, cylinder comes down, put some gas in there, you explode it. Okay, what does it do?
It pushes the piston up,
okay? And that eventually is connected to the instruments that turn the wheels on the car. But that's what it's doing. It's not quite the same, because in this case, you actually, the energy is absorbed in the material itself, and that is blown off, and you push the other material in this direction. Okay. It's more like a plane in that sense, because you're actually taking some of the, if you consider the gasoline as part of the plane, you're actually burning that off and thrusting that out this way and making the plane move this way. And so that's the simple part of ICF. Now, there's another part, and let me try to explain this to you. If you don't understand, it's important that you ask me, because it's a very important part of ICF. But this is a concept now, a physics concept, that won't be as easy to understand possibly. What you need to do, besides ablating the material outward and making the material come in and compressing it, is, well, one of the things you might ask yourself, why am I doing this? I mean, why not take this little sphere and just hit it with something and just heat it all up? Well, why do I compress it? Why not just heat the whole thing and let it burn? Now, the reason you don't want to do that is because you want some of the material that is burning to be absorbed in the fuel itself. So if I'm looking, this is an exaggeration, but suppose that I'm looking at a region of the fuel. It starts burning here. By burning, I mean there's an alpha particle which is released. It has energy. If that alpha particle can leave like that, then its energy is lost. Okay. I need a certain amount of material from this point to this point to extract the energy from that alpha particle. Okay. There isn't enough material there. I don't get the alpha particle's energy. Now, if I don't compress, what it means is that my little sphere has to be big. It's no longer a little sphere. It's a big sphere. And what does that do? It means that the laser or the ion beam or whatever I'm using has to be big. Okay? Much bigger. And it also means that the energy that's released from this target, this, by the way, is really huge. That's a big target. That would release a lot of energy. It would blow up all of Holden. Okay? And so, you don't want it big. So what you need to do is you need to compress the target so that you can capture those alpha particles so that they can help in the burning of the fuel itself. Okay? And that's very basic to ICF. That is one of the absolute necessary processes for inertial confinement fusion to work. And it's hard to do because you have to then make this implosion very symmetric so that you get a lot of compression.
How do you capture alpha particles?
They mostly slow down on electrons. You know what I mean by electrons? Yeah, most of it is slowing down on electrons. And then you transfer the energy from the electrons to the ions, just through collisionality. Okay. I don't know if other people understood that. There's a lot, what I realized when I was doing this is that there's a lot of different terms that we just take for granted. That, you know, what is an electron? Some of you probably are foggy. What in the heck is an electron? Electron has a mass about 2,000 times smaller than a proton. Maybe that helps a little bit. And it's negative charged, and a proton is positive charged. Okay? And so, this gives you an idea of what a target looks like. And I'm going to stop pretty soon. I was going to go into some other aspects of this, but I don't think I will because we're almost finished. This is a little target. You can see that it's really small. You know, in this particular case, this is one of the targets shot on the Nova laser at Livermore. And it's only a tenth of a centimeter in diameter. It has plastic for the shell. And it has deuterium and tritium frozen, so it's cold, really cold, film here. And again, as I told you, you compress this thing to even a much smaller diameter. You can see that this is about 20 times less the diameter of that, maybe even 30 times less. A tiny little thing. Okay. So that's what you're doing. And I'm going to show this is just to scare you. No, it's not. This is to pique your interest. This is for you, Stuart. Okay. And any other person who wants to change fields. This is the kind of terminology that I work with, and I don't expect you to understand this. But these are all of the different processes that I deal with in my daily life. You have the compression that I talked about. You have X-rays, the conversion into X-rays. You have hydrodynamics. That's just the movement of the shell from its original position inward. You have hot electrons. You have laser light. All these things going on. These are the kinds of terminology that you have to deal with.
Can I ask a quick, you know, everything else that we explode goes outward. There's nothing that ever condenses. And that, so is it the property of the element or whatever it is that does that?
Do you mean that causes the compression itself?
That's something I can't comprehend. Because everything else we blows apart when we ignite it.
Oh, this.
Why is there something? Is this
okay?
Special?
You're not igniting it. Remember.
Well, okay.
Okay.
Well, you're.
Well, you know, a way to think about. Well, let's see. Is this a good example? If I come over here to the wall and do that, okay. My hand didn't go through the wall. It bounced back and that. I did that. Put a shockwave through the wall. But in a sense, you could call it an explosion. It's a force. All I've done is I've applied a force to the surface of this object, and it's causing motion of another part of the object inward. Okay, so I have this sphere again. If I make it big now, I've applied a force out here, and it's driving inward the material. It's not an explosion, not in the initial phase. Okay, doesn't really burn until it's compressed and heated. In the process of compressing, it's heated. Okay, those occur at the same time. There are special ways of creating the pressure on the surface of the sphere to make it compress better and to heat it at the very end of the compression. I didn't talk about that because that's a more detailed aspect to the problem. What you do is you start out with a small amount of energy and build in time to more and more energy. So that at the very end, as the thing is collapsing down to the center, you deliver the most energy. Okay? Yeah?
Is this not something that's actually happening with the spheres of the Earth and all of your other things? Like, if you drill down into the Earth, well, we've seen explosions coming out of the Earth every once in a while with these volcanic explosions. Isn't that what's causing the heat in the center of the Earth? It's a pressure that's going in. What we call it is gravity.
Yeah, in fact, it is. There is that does happen when you, if in a local area, if there's an increase in pressure from the surface on a particular area on the Earth. You can imagine that the pressure is going to be released someplace.
Yeah.
You push down this way, and the pressure is released by going up that way.
Yeah,
that's right. That's what
I mean, isn't that a natural phenomenon that's actually
happening
throughout the universe?
Right, that's right. Well, I was going to show you some pictures of kind of reactor concepts for inertial confinement fusion, but I don't think I'll do that. I would prefer, because our time is up, to answer any questions that you might have about fusion. I didn't talk about radioactivity problems. That wasn't what my purpose was. Or this potential for the future, that's later.
Well then, you have to have some titanium or whatever it was you were talking about?
Tritium.
Okay. Is there enough of a supply of that to run out of oil? Like that, but you need so little of it that a lot goes a long way. Is that why it's a thing of the future, or can be?
You can manufacture it, but you can also actually do your implosion in such a way that you create it. You create more than you produce, or you create more than you've used.
That's a different concept than when I was in my old science classes, where you never end up with anything different than what you had before you when you mix elements together.
Now you can actually create tritium through the reaction processes. See, what you do is you minimize the amount of tritium you're using. You don't have an equal part of deuterium and tritium. You have much more deuterium than you have tritium, and the deuterium burning will give you tritium. Okay. In the near term, we won't do that. We'll have to produce our own tritium. Okay. But that's certainly, in the long term, we don't have to do that. We can produce it through the process itself. And one of the things that you might do is you would have a power plant that would, well, let's say you'd have three different or four different places where you were producing energy. One of them would be the place where you would produce tritium. I would guess that's probably the way it would go in the long term. So the other three would be used to maximize the yield, the energy, and the fourth one would be used to produce tritium. So
almost a perpetual motion machine type of concept. But you are fueling something.
Sure. Yeah. The nuclear energy is a fascinating area. I mean, one of the things that I found incredible was when you're comparing the waste associated with fission, for example. I don't know what it is with fusion, but the waste associated with fission products and compared to the waste with coal, it's unbelievable, the difference, volume difference. It's just incredible. Not only that, you have radioactive waste with coal. Not many people know that, more than you have with a fission plant.
Is there another way of maybe extracting the energy from coal itself?
Yes, there are. And there are other ways of burning coal. You know, that's a whole different area. There are other ways of burning it more efficiently. Like some of the things I was reading about is burning coal and natural gas together to burn coal more efficiently and to reduce the carbon dioxide emission and the nitrous oxide emissions. So you reduce the problem with greenhouse effect and reduce the problem with acid rain. There's a whole bunch of, just scads of different areas that need to be explored. Our country has been kind of, the research in our country needs to be going in a lot of different directions right now, and it's not.
You can see in coal gasification, like in North Dakota, what they're turning coal into a gas and then using
that. I'm not sure. Let's see. What do you turn coal into? Is it methane? Is that right? Yeah. What I would guess is that they're turning coal into methane, and then what I would be concerned
using
about
that to turn the turbines or
yeah. Well, you would burn methane then rather than the coal.
Yeah.
The thing that you want to look at is what are the pollutants in the process of turning coal into methane? What are you releasing into the environment? How efficient is that process? That's always what you want to look at. And any of the energy sources that people come in and say, oh, this is a great energy source, what is its efficiency? Okay, and what are the byproducts? All along the scale. If you're going to burn methane from coal, what happens when you go from coal to methane? And then what are the products that occur when you're burning methane? But you have to take both steps.
The thing that I have found most untrustworthy about the whole nuclear thing has been not so much on your end of it, mm-hmm. but on the management end of it. In Richland with Hanford, there has been so much lying. Mm-hmm. There has been so much incompetence that on that end of it, in other words, it's not being done according to the way that it has been prescribed by a scientist or something like that. And so when the lies become known and they're discovered, you know, they did release that stuff and they denied it for three
for
decades. And now, oh yeah, we did do it. It's that type of thing that really is the whole other end of this thing that, which in a sense has nothing to do with your end at all.
Yeah, the difficulty is that another area that our country has problems with is that the media is not very qualified a lot of the times. It's incredible the misinformation that you find in the media. Now, the way I would react to what you said is that how many things have you read about the tremendous waste from coal, radioactive waste from coal, for example, or the other problems? You've heard about the greenhouse effect now. People begin to talk about that. But typically that's talked about in a general sense. You're not isolating. Coal is one of the worst producers of CO2. 30 to 40% of the CO2 emitted in our country is from coal. Okay. But you don't hear that. But the part of that is just because of our focus, okay, and the knowledge of the people that are involved in the media.
And the lobbies that don't want it heard.
Don't want it heard,
also
that's right.
Also the fear of what you don't understand as much. Either.
Sure, yeah. And I think that when I talk to you about the energy risks, that you'll be concerned. On the other hand, I hope that you'll take it back and talk about it with other people that you know and try to get more information about what the risks are associated with all of the different energies. Try to get a better view of what's going on rather than the media's view, I guess, is the way I would put it.
Person right now wonders just what the effect is going to be with all that burning oil in the Middle East.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what the effect is there. Certainly, my guess is it's going to have an effect in that area, but what kind of an effect it has outside the area, I don't think anybody can predict. But tremendous pollution in that area, right?
Any fish burning? I think that could be carried around the world. The explosion from Russia could have traveled across the United States and saw it, and there's no reason why that doesn't happen.
That's right. That's right. No, that's absolutely right. What I was saying is that I don't know how to predict or to tell you what its effect will be. That's very hard to do.
The conference of the new scientists now that are going to improve what's going to happen at Holden, for instance, will that, this knowledge that you told us about today, will that have any effect on Holden?
Not for a long time.
Right. Okay. Now, whatever you do here at Holden, could that be transferred to Ottumwa, Iowa? Our problems? Or is this something that's going to be peculiar to?
No. Yeah, that's a good point. No, there are a lot of things that can be transferred. I think one of the things that's already happening here that's important for all of the cities, including Los Alamos, I'm disappointed that Los Alamos hasn't done it, is to segregate your garbage, okay? To look at your garbage and to segregate it into recyclable areas, into areas that can be combusted, into areas that, you know, can be used for fertilizer. That process, I think, should be done everywhere. I mean, we're a miniature here of all of the city problems. Okay. When you hear about the large cities trucking their garbage, there are cities trucking their garbage all across the United States. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. Los Angeles has terrible garbage problems right now. From what I've read in the media, they do anyway. And I know that garbage is being trucked from one state to another state. We have water problems. And I think there are going to be state fights over water. California is in their sixth drought. we have to be very careful about the water here at Holden. We have a water tower that has to be replaced, but only mentioned one aspect of that. We also have to have a filtration system on that. And in fact, a filtration system and a chlorination system. One of the problems that we had over the last 10 years is that the chlorination system, the chlorine leaked, not all the time, but a little bit, and it corroded the tower. So we had to study that corrosion problem last time I was here and see how much damage to the tank occurred. And so, and the question is what kind of filtration system do you use? Okay. One of the things I noticed a couple days ago, I'll tell you now, since it's already happened, is that the water wasn't clear. So the first thing that I did was I talked to Jim about it, because Jim is the head of that. I don't know if you realize that, but I think it was the afternoon, not yesterday, but the day before. Maybe it was yesterday. But it was not clear. It was murky water. And the first thought in my mind was, wait a minute. Now that I'm aware of all of these other things, you know, the other part of Holden, you know, what's going on? How did this water get through? And was it checked in the morning? What was the turbidity of the water, for example, which means how dirty was it?
We found out that in our town now, we're just starting this yard waste pickup on Mondays and regular garbage on Tuesdays, and cans and so forth on Wednesdays and so forth. You get that. Wow, it's the population that just exploded. Mm-hmm. Letters to the editor took two pages, but you could be one column. You know?
Yeah, no, I know. People don't want to be bothered until...
How can we stand to have our garbage sit here for a whole week? Think of the flies in August and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somebody told me here that he works here. said that everybody should go on Garbology at least one day.
Right.
And get a feeling for how much garbage these few hundred people come right. with in the day's time.
Now, I get to experience that on Friday. Now, I haven't done that, but I already have a good feeling for it. I'm as much to blame as, you know, for our situation as anyone else in this room. I mean, that's a matter of deciding that you're going to change, you know, that there's a change that's needed. But not only in that area and in many other areas. One of the other things that I'll mention that's important probably to everyone here, I know it is for my parents, one of the things that's been talked about is reducing the amount of energy use, and so people have gone to much more efficient ways of keeping the energy within their homes. My dad, through PUD, had all of his windows replaced with much more efficient windows. That's really a good thing to do, but one of the things that you want to be careful about is that during the winter that you don't build up a lot of gases, toxic gases. And so I have a picture of the different places where you could build up toxic gases in your home. So if you have a home that is really tight, you want to be looking at that. And if you have any questions about that, come to me and I'll give you an idea of what to be looking for and what you might do. So you got to be careful about doing things like that. It's still important, I think, to reduce your energy as much as you can. But you also want to do some things in your house, like in your bedroom, you might want to open a window for a certain period of time to get new air into the house.
I remember back when I was in North Dakota, they talked about this is reducing your amount of electricity you use, mm-hmm. and they used the financial aspect of that to say that it would be cheaper than moving that bigger bill. Well, then what happened was that people did reduce, but then the price per unit went up. So they were spending exactly the same, and so people just got gun-shy and said, oh, phooey, it's mm-hmm. just another gimmick. And so, you know, it's the management of that type of thing
yeah.
to convince people it is to your interest. It may not be directly in your pocketbook, but it's to your interest and the interest of the world or the country or, all, you know.
Yeah, you have to. Here, I have a good environment to talk to people, but part of it is selfishness. I mean, most of the things that we talk about, energy efficiency, for example, is what you're talking about. And if you didn't have any other preconceptions, it's common sense. I mean, it's not sensible to throw the garbage out the way we do. I mean, if you sat down and thought about it, you know, just cleared your mind for a moment and thought about what you were doing, it doesn't make sense to do that. Okay. It makes sense only if you're on an island with no one else and somehow the garbage disappears in the ocean. And, you know. But when you're with people, you have a limited space like we do on the globe, it doesn't make sense to do that.
Wouldn't manufacturing plants, shouldn't they be thinking about making products that are not so, foam cups and all these things that they bake, you know, can't they help the situation?
Sure, and they are.
Yeah, they should
have to. Foam cups, for example, about 25% of the styrofoam cups are being recycled now, mm-hmm. and within 10 years, I think it's going to be about 60% that are recycled. But you can also think about moving to different areas, like, is it possible, one of the things that came to mind when somebody talked about using renewable sources, and I looked at styrofoam and we looked at paper. One of the things that came to mind immediately is it possible to manufacture chemically polystyrene? I mean, now you use petroleum products, but it's not clear to me that you can do it from scratch. And so, you know, is it renewable or isn't it? I don't know.
You know, it does not encourage you to do that.
No, they're not encouraged to do that. That's right.
Yeah, because one day got in a bind with a group that came and did not have enough cups. And so I was going to quick run over to the store and buy some hot cups for coffee, paper.
I've experienced that.
They were right beside each other.
Yeah.
I could buy 50 styrofoam cups for, what was it, 60 cents or something like that. And for 50 paper cardboard ones, it was $4.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I again, if you have interest in other things, you know, other you know, I've talked about my professional aspect of things, but other areas that you're interested in my professional area too, come and see me.
Thank you.
Thank you.